Well, Monty Hall was the official host of a game show that ran from the 1970s to about 1990. And Marilyn Beau Savant was writing this column for Parade magazine. She's officially listed as having the highest IQ ever recorded.
Have
considerable support. Well, what I want to do is to analyze this using the basic principles of probability. I mean, there are various shortcuts by which you can indicate which is the better answer. But what I want to do is to use this as a pretext for explaining the basic principles of probability and how that would apply to this problem. And then, starting from this as a base, just jump off and indicate some of the basic quarrels within the statistics profession, which, by the way, are still out there. They're not by no means resolved. Okay, probability. There's about a dozen different approaches which indicate that the fundamental way of dealing with uncertainty is by means of the calculus of probability. All of them, there's quite varied approaches, but they all lead to the same basic type of structure. First of all, what sorts of things do probabilities apply? The answer is the statements. You have statement A, something which could be true or false. And P of A is an indication of the degree of credibility that you will give to this statement. You're uncertain, so there's a set of possibilities. I'll call this possibility space. You think of lots of possibilities, sometimes an infinite number of possibilities, sometimes a finite number. Each of these could be have a very rich internal structure. But in any case, there's a set of possibilities. In statistics, this sort of entity is called the sample space, but that's actually a very poor and misleading term. So I'll call it possibility space. A statement A will be true under certain of these possibilities and false under certain other possibilities. So you can identify a statement A with a subset of this possibility space. Here's A. If I have another statement B, that would be represented by another subset of this. And then A and B would be represented by the intersection of these two. That is, the points inside here are those points, those possibilities of which both A and B are true. A or B would correspond to the union of these two sets. Not A correspond to the complement. So you have a perfect correspondence between these Boolean operations on statements and these corresponding Boolean operations on sets. Now, the basic principles of probability really boil down to three. The first one is that P of A is a number between 0 and 1. 1 representing complete certainty that A is true, 0 representing complete certainty that A is false, and PA being somewhere in between, indicating the degree of credibility that you assign to the statement A. The second principle is that if A and B are disjoint, that is to say, this is the set of possibilities for A, the set of possibilities for B, and they don't overlap, then probability you assign to A or B is simply the sum of the two. And the third possibility concerns conditional probability. This probability of A conditional on B, and the meaning of that is, suppose you were given the information that B is true, then what would the credibility of A be in your eyes? So that's the basic concept there. And the third principle is that this is equal to the probability of A and B divided by probability of B. And in terms of inference, if you observe something, your probabilities are going to change. That is, let's suppose A represents whether it's going to rain tomorrow. Okay, well, I should go along. I can listen to a weather forecast. I can look up at the sky. I can is something that's going to change over time as new evidence comes in, so that you could actually have a time series.
Let's give these things some names. This thing over here.
prior to looking at the evidence. This is the credibility I assign after looking at the evidence. And this third term up here is called the likelihood. Now, what I want to do is to suppose I have a range of these hypotheses, and I assign probabilities to each of them. If they're exhaustive and exclusive, then I have to add up to one, and they're non-negative. And then after examining the evidence, I will reassign. There'll be new weights, which again are non-negative and add up to one. If you take a look at this formula, you see that the denominator does not involve any of these hypotheses. So, just to make life very simple, I'll just say that this thing over here is proportional to this number right here. In other words, to go from the prior to the posterior, what you do is multiply by the likelihood, you get a bunch of new numbers, typically they won't add up to one, and then you just multiply them through by a constant to make them add up to one again. So it's very, very simple in terms of the basic structure. And having got this far, let's now apply it to the Monte Hall problem. Okay, so here's ABC, and my three hypotheses are the prizes behind A, behind B, and behind C. And by assumption, it's exclusive and exhaustive, so they add up to one. And by the symmetry of the problem, let's just suppose that each one of these is one-third. So these are the prior probabilities. Okay, now let's consider the likelihood. The evidence is going to be observing Monte Hall opening one of the two doors that you haven't picked up, and naturally observing that there's no prize behind that door. So let's suppose that I call A and Monte Hall opens door C. Okay. What I have to ask is, what is the probability that that particular event happens? That's the E, given H. Clear that no matter what Monte Hall does, I have a one-third chance of winning, namely if it was originally. On the other hand, suppose I decide always to switch. In that case, I'm going to win, but suppose I name A and I always switch. In that case, I'm going to win whether either B or C has the drive behind me. And therefore, two chances out of three. So that's a shortcut. But this way always works. Shortcuts aren't always available. So, because this is what Marilyn did, and for some odd reason, loads and loads of very, very competent people thought she was crazy. So that was the beginning of this this argument. And I do believe that what's going on here has something to do with people's fundamental conceptions of what probability is. Because this is by no means the only conception. In fact, it's not even the majority conception among statisticians as to what probability is. The so-called frequency theory is still rather more popular, although the Bayesian approach is gained. Okay, let me, before I go on to issues of that sort, let me consider a slight variant of this problem, which may have been one of the reasons why there was so much controversy. Suppose that Monte Carlo does not know where the prize is. Okay, so you name A, and he thinks either B or C, not knowing which is the prize, so he might by chance uncover the prize. Let's see what happens under those conditions. So you win if he opens it. If he opens a ball with the prize,
I know it wasn't the one that you named.
Well, it's hard to say because this is not the way that show was conducted. But I'm saying let's take a variant of that show in which Monte Carlo himself does not know which door contains the prize, and see what would happen under those. Okay, well, so what's going to happen is exactly the same as before. I name A, and he opens C, and it turns out that there's nothing behind it. There's no prize behind it. That's the evidence. Again. So let's see, what is the probability that would have happened if the prize was actually behind A? Well, the answer is, again, one half. Right? Because he doesn't know what's going to happen. You name A, he's going to choose B and C at random, and he has a 50-50 chance of choosing either one. So that again is one half. How about B? Well, that's again one half, because he doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know where the prize is at all, so that's, you name A, he's going to choose at random between these two, so that again is one half. And finally, we do know, however, that the prize is not at C, because that's the moment. Okay, well, let's go through our same rigmarole, although it's pretty obvious what the result is going to be. Third times a half is a sixth. Third times a half is a sixth. This adds up to one third. I multiply through by three, and I get one half. One half. So in this case, if you have an ignorant Monte Carlo, the other conclusion is correct. Namely, it doesn't make any difference whether you switch or not. So I suspect had this unconsciously in mind, perhaps. In other words, this is really quite subtle, because what's going on there, the way you get information out of this is by the fact that Monte Carlo himself is giving you some kind of hint as to what's going on by his choice. So that's rather subtle. Okay, now what I want to do is to turn to statistics. Because I do think it would be interesting to take a look at the people who were in each of these columns, the ones who advocated one solution versus the ones who advocated another, and see what their ideology is, so to speak, concerning the nature of probability. My own guess is, in fact, that the Bayesians would generally come up with the correct solution, and the frequentists would not. In any case, let me go on to Laura Fisher and to Naaman and Pearson. And these are the classical, the most prominent statisticians of this century. I actually had the fortune to hear R.A. Fisher 1 year before he died. I gave a talk at Columbia University And I was also out at Berkeley, where Naaman was. He was still on the faculty in his 80s, and he actually died a few weeks after I left there. So, but I don't think I put eggs on either one of them. In any case, what's involved here? We didn't make any distinction over here between hypothesis and evidence. They're all treated as propositions, and they're all subject to the probability calculus. In the so-called classical or frequentist approach, we make a very, very sharp distinction between hypotheses and evidence. And you're not allowed to assign probabilities to all things. You're only allowed to assign probabilities to those things which are in principle repeatable. So if I have the outcome of an experiment, I can assign a probability to it because I can repeat that experiment over and over again. And in fact, the probability itself is defined in some sense or other as the long-term relative frequencies of what would happen as a result of this experiment repeated over and over again. On the other hand, a hypothesis is something that just, let's say, refers to some kind of law or something. It doesn't make any sense, according to this particular point of view, to assign probabilities. So it's completely forbidden to put an H on the left-hand side of this bar over there, and therefore you just can't use Bayes' theorem to do anything. You've got to go through different ways of doing it. And let me talk first of all about R.A. Fisher and significance tests.
Either the null hypothesis falls for a very
that's the first principle of Fisher. There's actually two fallacies involved in this approach, the second of which is needed to preserve the first, so to speak. The first fallacy is precisely this statement. If the probability of the evidence given a hypothesis is false, that indicates that the VH is unlikely to be true. Suppose my hypothesis, suppose I make a coin. My hypothesis is that this is a fair coin. Suppose I toss this coin 100 times. What's the probability that of that event? Well, it's a half, times a half, times a half, times a half. It's 2 to the minus 100 power. That's a very small number. And therefore, under Fisher's principle, if we toss a coin 100 times, we should reject the hypothesis that the coin is fair. Something seems to be wrong, because it doesn't matter what the sequence is. Any sequence whatsoever, even one that seems very irregular, is going to have a probability of 2 to the minus 100 power. So no matter what you do, you're going to reject that hypothesis. Obviously, something is wrong. And indeed, that is true. The second fallacy is involved in this tale. And this, I think fallacy of this particular approach is very important to recognize now. And it's certainly not taught in stat courses as something that you should do anymore. The tale thing is much less known as a fallacy. And the problem is this. I observe a particular value of x over here. Why should I be concerned with the tail? I should be concerned with the actual value of x that I observe, not with the tail. There's a famous quotation from Harold Jeffries who says that according to this approach, it's held against the hypothesis that it does not predict what didn't happen. Okay, so in other words, actually, what we want to take a look at something like this: the probability that, let's say, x is equal to this particular value x that we observed in the edge. Now, the tail then is something that you're adding on. I mean, it's like you have a chemist doing an assay. Let's say he gets a value of 7, and he reports not 7, but 7 or greater. Truth, but not the whole truth. What you wanted to do is tell you, well, I observed something which is essentially 7. Maybe 7 plus or minus epsilon, but certainly who cares about what's out here? What you should do is then condition it on the evidence that you actually observed, not this hypothetical tale out here. Okay, so that's the second fallacy. You can see why you have to do something like this, because if you have a continuous distribution, the probability of any particular value is very, very small indeed. Strictly speaking, zero. And therefore, that would immediately violate Fisher's dictum over here, no matter what the observation was. I choose a point from a normal distribution. Well, the probability of any particular point is zero, no matter what it is. So obviously, this particular thing would tell us to reject the hypothesis no matter what I observe. There's something wrong. Okay, so that's R.A. Fisher. And as I said, not taught in statistics courses here anymore as something to be advocated. What is taught is the approach to Neyman and Pearson. Consider the alternatives, not just H naught, the null hypothesis, but other H's. And you can see we're getting a little bit closer to that overall scheme that I put on the board before. On the other hand, Neyman and Pearson are even more insistent than Fisher was that you cannot assign anybody ever understood what he was trying to do, and that is more or less the fun. But Neyman and Pearson absolutely insist that you can't do that, and that leads to certain rather strange results. And what I would like to do is to talk very quickly about the theory of confidence intervals. This is a bit more technical than what we've been doing so far. And I'll also change my notation slightly. So what seems to be, this is hypothesis space. A set of hypotheses that you are considering. And it's convenient to think of it as representing it. Then you want to, let's let theta be a parameter which indexes the different hypotheses. Over here on right observation space, going to have a probability distribution over x, and you have to think of this density function as representing the point vertically. So this particular theta value, let's say, is going to have a density function in the x space like that. So that previous diagram that I put on the board is now rotated 90 degrees. Okay, so we have this, and let's do this for each of the possible theta values. I'm going to have that by this one over here, so I have this minor distribution. What I do now is select a certain interval of x's such that the probability of the observation lying in that interval, given theta, is, say, 0.94. Okay, so what I'll do, in other words, particular theta, I'm going to have I theta is an interval in x space. And it's chosen so that the probability that x belongs to this interval, given theta, is 0.94. Typically, you take readings of high density. So, let's say this region over here, this region over here, this region over here. And I get what you might call the two specs. So, each particular theta, this is going to be a typical Y. Now, that is uniquely determined. It's not uniquely determined. I mean, so typically, what try to make the interval as small as possible, which means make the density function as high as you possibly can. At the highest density. Okay, but suppose you do this, and now let's consider intervals that look like that. Okay, any particular observation about Ix. So Ix is going to be an interval in the theta space. And Neyman pointed out that this event is the same as this event. In other words, theta belongs to this Ix interval, if and only if x belongs to the I theta interval. Because both of these say that the pair theta comma x is inside this tumor. It's two different ways of saying the same thing. Therefore, you get the probability that theta belongs to Ix theta 0.95. And this is what Neyman called confidence interval. It's a region in the parameter space, in other words, the space of the hypotheses, such that this is true. Well, it seems very clever. Not a la Neyman, but you're making the very point I'm coming to. There's something wrong with this. And what's wrong with it is this theta over here. What you really want is an x over there. Because x, after all, is what you observe. That's what you observe. But this would be absolutely prohibited under the name and Pearson approach. Because, essentially, this would make the theta over here your random variable. Assigning probabilities to the theta. See, over here, you can think of this. If you're conditioning on theta, this thing is fixed, and this is the random point. It's the interval itself that is random. And of course, you can do that over and over again in an experiment and get a different interval each time. And he's indeed correct that 95% of the time, these intervals, these random intervals, will cover the true value of theta. This thing over here would fix the interval. That's an absolute taboo under the Feynman Pearson approach. And yet, it seems to contradict what we were saying before, namely that when you observe something, you should condition everything on what you observe. And indeed, I will now show that this approach sometimes leads to absurdity. Let's take the special case where theta and x are independent. In other words, distribution, probability distribution over the observations does not depend on theta. Okay, let's see what that would look like. So in other words, here's the particular theta, here's the distribution over x, here's a different theta, get exactly the same distribution. Same distribution, etc. So if you draw your two, horizontal. In other words, this is y theta. That's got to be the same for all x's. Okay. Get a horizontal tube like that, in which the probability of x lying at that interval is 1/5. No matter what theta it is, it's independent. Now, let's follow. Says, okay, this is the same thing over here. The IX, what would the IX be? If X is inside over here, IX is entire space, entire parameter space. So he says the probability of lying somewhere at all is 0.95. But of course, it's actually 1. It has to be somewhere. On the other hand, that's pretty bad, but worse, be the case where at 5% of the time where the x lies outside. But now we get the empty set. So according to the Neyman approach, the probability of being an empty set is 0.95. Which doesn't make any sense to us because that's automatically zero if it has any meaning at all. So you can get absurdities, and this is not that uncommon. I can give you a reference if you want, in which you get all sorts of phenomena like that. Essentially, when the hypothesis space is relatively narrow, rather than spread out, you're more likely to get this phenomena. In any case, there's something basically wrong with this. And I think you put your finger on it. What's wrong with it, namely, that the wrong thing conditioning over here. You have to get X, but that means you have to go outside the overall framework of so-called objective probability. Are they two different things, or are they one thing. There's two different things. What's the relationship between them? And that's one thing. How can it be both subjective and objective at the same time? But, I don't know. Maybe I should just... Any questions? Yeah, I'm going back to the problem. Did anybody approach it to see what Marty Powell was actually doing? You're making hypotheses about what he does.
Yeah.
And earlier you said sometimes you open it up and there immediately and there was a...
Yeah, well, I have an article. My son reprinted an article that appeared in the New York Times with an interview with Marty Powell. And he essentially said he didn't follow principles. Sometimes I said he would guess A and he would hold an A and show you that there's nothing behind it and say sorry. Another time when he said, somebody said, would you like to switch? And he said, well, I'll offer you, the prize is a car, so it was actually a driving price. Said, well, I'll offer you X $1,000 if you don't switch. So the more he offered, the more eager they were to switch. Because the final, where the price is, would of course eliminate one of these little parameters of the problem. But the general case is going to have 11 parameters. You can have two parameters because the original probability, the general case, PA, PB, PC, that's 2 degrees of freedom because they have to add up to 1. And then, for each of these 9 circumstances, namely which door you choose, and which is the true value of the prize, there's going to be a certain probability on his opening this door versus that door. So it's actually an 11 parameter problem, which is quite tricky. Let me just mention another one. Maybe you see it intuitively. You've done quite well in terms of intuition. Suppose that I have a problem in which Monty Hall knows where the prize is. You, however, assign numbers PA, PB, PC. That's your probabilities that you assign to where you think the prize might be. And you also have 3 different probabilities. Let's say you name A. If the prize is behind B or C, then of course Monty Hall must, he's constrained to choose the third one. But if the prize is behind A, then he can choose either one of these things, and you have to assign a probability that he's going to choose B as opposed to C. That's just the 5 parameter problem. You have to say, here's P, A, B, B, and P, C. That's my original prior distribution. Then there's P, A, B. PAB is the probability that if I choose A and the prize is behind A, Monty will choose B as the correct order. Because now we have a choice. PAC would be the other possibility if these things don't add up to 1, so they have 1 degree of freedom. So you have a 5 parameter problem because you have to have PAB and then PBC or PBA and then PCB or PCA. You have 5 parameters. What do you think the optimal strategy is to maximize the chance of getting the prize? Suppose for simplicity, right? The rankings are like that in terms of probability. It's actually a very simple answer.
Switch.
Okay, but which do you guess initially? Yeah, you have to do that. You have to, first of all, guess.
Oh.
You have to name A, B, or C. And then you have to decide whether to stay or to switch. That's the optimal strategy. No matter what. In other words, if you solve the 5 parameter problem, you choose the least likely, and then you switch. And if you do that, the probability of winning is PB plus PC. equal one minus the other. No matter what money holds propensity. So I mean this requires calculation. We'll actually have to sit down and calculate. But that would be a that would be the solution to that problem.
You said British went with minority view. Right. Is there evidence to clarify his logic or someone?
Well, actually that was an interesting story. There were two biographies of British recently appeared. One called The Man Who Loved Only Numbers, and the other one is called My Brain Is Open. Okay? And that the second one is actually by Ron Graham. Well, I'm sure you've heard of him. He's a government. For both of these books talk about this particular incident that Erdős chose the incorrect solution. And Graham explains it as he thinks of probability as something that is welded to a certain event. In other words, it's an inherent property of this event. And it doesn't make any sense for probabilities to change. In his use of the probabilistic method, he never uses conditional probability. So he doesn't have to worry about the problem. It's not probability in the sense that statistical methods. But that was his explanation.
That was Graham's conjecture about his.
That was Graham's conjecture about why.
On the basis of the discussions with him, he should just ask that.
Erdős never really explained it very carefully. This is what Graham conjectures is involved behind here. It's very difficult to psychoanalyze somebody and figure out why they have a particular slant. But that's what he figured. And it seems to me that really this kind of idea that probability is something that's welded to a particular event and can't depart from it. There's something that's involved in the frequent misconception of an experiment. There's an experiment that I do the experiment over and over again, and the same fundamental probability is on. I may not know what the probability is. It's something that I can estimate by taking a look at the relative frequency by which this outcome or that outcome occurs. But it's something that's in there. In other words, you're assuming a certain stationarity characteristic. That's implicitly involved in the whole frequency. Not believing these calculations, that people actually went out and they assigned you do the switching strategy and you do the picking strategy. Needless to say, the people who start won about 1/3 of the time, and the people who switched won about 2/3 of the time. That went to several thousand trials. Seems to be right. I just don't understand why it works that way. It just seems to be right. So, yeah.
How about the real data? Simulations, how about the real data?
Yeah, well, this is, it's in this article over here. Who mentions,
what happened in the real?
Well, that's what happened. It came out, there are numbers here. Several thousand trials, and it came out
I mean, how could it be anything different?
Well, those are simulations, right? Those, you aren't saying they went through the whole history of the quiz show, looked at how many times actually on a quiz show.
No, I think people actually said, you know, you saw in different strategies, you know, let's see if the strategy works and that strategy works. Well, I mean, this problem is so simple that you can actually analyze it. Assuming that the only thing you're not sure of is, does he actually choose these two at random? He might have a preference for B as opposed to C.
Or might have a preference
skew the results. But in any case, I mean, no matter what his preference is, your optimal solution is always the solution. So no matter, I mean, even in the extreme case, where he chooses, he has a consistent bias toward one of these, he'd never do worse by switching. And in every other case, he'd do better by switching.
Thank you.